Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the IASA Legal Podcast. I'm your host, IASA General Counsel Chad Watkins. The podcast is part of IASA's expanded member services, which include the Legal Corner articles in our monthly magazine, Leadership Matters, and our upcoming superintendent legal panels. Be on the lookout for more information about those. Among the participants in the upcoming panels are the attorneys from Franzic. And with us today from Franzic are today's podcast guests, Dana Fattori-Crumley and Shelly Anderson. Shelly and Dana are partners at Franzic, a Chicago-based law firm with one of the largest teams of K-12 attorneys in Illinois. Franzic works with school districts, schools, and cooperatives of all sizes, ranging from hundreds to thousands of students in all areas of our state. Shelly has 20-plus years of experience representing school districts in all areas of labor and employment law. She is a frequent speaker for the Illinois Association of School Personnel Administrators and other organizations dedicated to advising school leaders in all aspects of human resources, and is often called upon by school districts to conduct high-profile investigations and discipline matters. Dana also represents school districts in labor and employment matters and also practices in the areas of special education and student rights. Dana is a former public school teacher and a former member and president of the Winnetka Public Schools District 36 Board of Education. Dana and Shelly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
So for the first time this year, our podcast is taking a step away from COVID-related concerns and going back to more traditional school law issues. Today's podcast will feature HR 101, an overview of essential employment laws and considerations. We're going to start with teacher and administrator employment. And my first question is, what are the ways teachers can accrue tenure in Illinois?
Thanks, Chad. This is Shelly. I will take that question. This is definitely a different answer than we would have given you a number of years ago before the law changed, because it typically was just one way. And that was for a teacher to obtain, 4 years of consecutive service with the school district. When the change of the law came with PARA and the new rating system, we now actually have 3 ways that a teacher can attain tenure in a school district. And one of those would be getting 4 ratings of proficient or better, having 3 excellent ratings in the same school district, or if you have a teacher who was in a school district and acquired tenure there, when they come into your school district, if they get 2 excellent evaluations and they have had the information given to you at the beginning of the school year with respect to the evaluations they received from their prior school district, they may also be able to obtain tenure in your school district that way. So it's really important to make sure that you know and are mindful of what ratings your teachers are getting as they're moving through the process.
Great. Thank you, Shelly. What about principals, superintendents, and other administrators? Do they acquire tenure?
They don't receive tenure in the same way. Now, they can receive tenure, but in their underlying teaching positions. So nobody is like, you have tenured teachers, but you don't have necessarily tenured principals, tenured superintendents, and tenured administrators. They are tenured in whatever their underlying teaching degree is. Administrators are governed by contracts, which I know we're going to talk about, but either a 1-year or a multi-year contract, and that contract is for the administrative position. But if they are employed, if they meet the requirements that Shelly just went over, and they meet one of those 3 ways, they would accrue tenure in your school district as a licensed educator, a licensed employee.
Great. Thank you, Dana. What are the requirements for multi-year employment contracts? And how does a multi-year contract affect the acquisition of tenure?
Well, I'll start with kind of what the requirements are, Chad. And when you have a multi-year contract, it has to include at its inception, a specific student performance as well as academic improvement goals. It has to have at least 1 of each. And the student performance goals would be something related to student behavior or achievement related to the learning goals. So something related to reducing student discipline, improving student graduation rates, things like that. On the other side of academic improvement goals, that's tied directly to scholastic improvement. So that could be improving an academic area or doing an analysis of test scores and reporting back to the board or the superintendent. The one important thing there is that, I said at its inception, there have been some court cases out there that do address whether or not a multi-year contract is valid if the goals are not there at the time it is executed by the school board. So you often see some administrator contracts that purport to be multi-year that say the goals will be decided at a later date between the board or the superintendent and the administrator, for instance. And that, in my opinion, is not technically a valid multi-year contract. It is okay if there are some goals that satisfy what I just described, and then they are supplemented later. For instance, if it's a new superintendent coming in, doesn't know the district well, you can certainly expand on those goals at that time. But that requirement of having at least those goals at the time the contract is entered into, we need to make sure that that's there. And I think that that's a piece that sometimes gets lost. With respect to the second part of your question, Dana started to touch on it, but if you are under a multi-year contract, you are waiving your rights under 2412 to 2416 of the school code during the period of that multi-year contract, which means that with respect to your tenure rights, as well as the rights that you have for a tenure teacher dismissal, for instance, the administrator under a multi-year contract would not have those rights during the term of the contract. So if they were going to be terminated, for instance, we wouldn't follow the teacher dismissal process that's in the school code. We would follow a different process, perhaps dictated by the contract itself and for the cause provision that's in the contract. That being said, if that administrator had acquired tenure prior to a multi-year contract, so that would be either, you know, 4 consecutive years under single-year contracts in the district, or perhaps as a teacher in the district, the administrator doesn't then lose that previously acquired tenure just because they enter into a multi-year contract. So you really have to, as an administrator, kind of balance which one is more important. Do you want the protections of the school code as they exist if you're in a single-year contract, or is it more important for you to have kind of that multi-year commitment from the school board?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point, Shelley, because we have lots of districts that have administrators hired on one-year contracts repeatedly, because I think sometimes the board feels like, I'm not committing for such a long time, I don't want to give a 3-year contract. And I sort of follow that rationale for the first year. But after that, I do think it's more important to put an administrator on a multi-year contract and set some goals. I think from a community optic perspective, that is, like, those are the leadership positions of the school district. You want them to reflect what the objectives and the goals and working on those things. And, you know, there's nothing worse. It's like, what do they say about day-old fish, than like a principal that you really want to let go, but they're tenured, and then all of a sudden they're like the computer teacher and they're, you know, bitter. That is just an awkward, that doesn't, usually people find other jobs, I will say, in my experience, but that's an awkward situation that no one really wants to be find themselves in. And that's what happens sometimes when you have these serial single-year contracts and people getting tenure.
Shelley, one follow-up from your comments. Let's say that you happen to enter into a multi-year contract that doesn't have goals at the outset. How would you suggest rectifying that situation?
You know, I've had that happen more than once, and I would say that in the event that you have a board administrator who just realized that they did not do that from the onset, I would make sure that the goals are there as soon as you realize that, and then have the board take action to ratify the contract with the goals attached. It's going to be a very unlikely circumstance that it is going to be a third party that's going to come forward and point out that it might not be a valid contract because the goals weren't attached. So this shouldn't be that big of an issue if it's realized, but I do think that rectifying it as soon as possible is in everyone's best interest.
All right. Thank you. What rules apply for dismissal for cause under a multi-year contract? What about termination at the end of the contract term? How is it different?
So if an administrator is dismissed in the middle of a contract term, you do have to satisfy cause. And usually the contract will refer to just cause, and it'll lay out a process of how you would effectuate the dismissal, which would include a hearing, some sort of hearing process. It's really driven by the contract terms. And, you know, what cause is really defined by the case law and by you know, it's somewhat defined by the employment relationship as it emerges between the superintendent and the board and what the expectations are. I mean, common reasons why or common causes for dismissal might be insubordination, you know, repeated failure to follow through on things that the superintendent was saying that he was going to do and he or she is not doing them. You know, conduct outside the district that is, you know, clearly causing damage to the district might be constitute cause for dismissal under a multi-year contract. It's not the same standard, the same high standard as we talk about when we're dismissing tenured teachers. At the end of the contract term, it's different. It's really any, you know, I think we talked about this before we started recording, any non-discriminatory reason. The contract is over. If the administrator doesn't have tenure in the district, it's just the end of the contract term. But there's still rules to follow. And again, that's dictated by the contract. You're going to have different notice requirements about when the board needs to evaluate the superintendent, inform the superintendent of the contract not being renewed. And those things are very important for both sides to be mindful of as you work through this, as you work through the separation, no matter how it comes to be.
What guidelines does an administrator need to follow in dismissing a non-tenured teacher for cause? And how is dismissal of a non-tenured teacher for cause different than a reduction in force?
Well, I think this is one area that, you know, especially a new administrator can find themselves, you know, not realizing that we always talk about these really high standards and the process that we follow for tenured teachers. So whether we're talking about a notice to remedy or whether it's remediable or irremediable conduct, I know we're going to talk about in a little bit. For a non-tenured teacher, it's really different. And when you look at the school code, it talks about, you know, conduct that shows that they can't be a role model for kids, for instance, or is there gross insubordination. The level of conduct that can result in dismissal is much lower. And so the process that you would follow would be a hearing process before the school board. And I typically do still draft up what appear, you know, what would look like perhaps charges, not as detailed as you would for a tenured teacher, but making sure that you've got something in writing that you've presented to the teacher explaining the basis for cause. And again, we're talking about this would be a mid-year termination and giving the tenured teacher an opportunity to appear before the school board and express his or her position on the issue as to why they don't think they should be terminated or why they didn't engage in the conduct alleged. And then the board can make a determination if they want to go forward with that. And that, of course, all happens in closed session. And the board action would be taken in open session coming out of closed if they decided to terminate. So that's kind of the process that's followed. It is, we definitely want to take it seriously, but it's not the same thing as if we have a tenured teacher that we are dealing with. It's significantly different than a reduction in force because one, it happens at any time during the school year that you deem that the teacher should be terminated for the conduct they engaged in. A reduction in force is something that we do and it really, it's not that we're picking a specific teacher that's going to be reduced. I think we have some new administrators who sometimes think, well, this teacher's not doing well, so we'll, you know, we're going to pick this person to necessarily to do a reduction in force. That would be a non-renewal of a probationary teacher, which you always have the right to do at the end of the school term. A reduction in force is really when we're talking about, do we not need as many teachers as we've had before due to a decline in student enrollment or a budget reason or some other reason. And that is then done by a grouping system that's very specific in the school code. Your joint committee will have worked on it. So there are, you know, three different ways that we're talking about here is kind of dismissal for cause, an honorable dismissal, which follows the grouping process, and then a non-renewal process that occurs at the end of the school year.
All right, I'm now going to move to a much more involved process, and that is the dismissal of tenured teachers. So what are the laws and regulations that apply to them when they're being dismissed for cause?
So we always talk about the dismissal of a tenured teacher being a more difficult process, and it is, but it is not impossible. So the process is laid out in Article 24. Teachers can be dismissed for cause, tenured teachers, either when they fail to remediate after being placed on a remediation plan, which is one sort of avenue or path towards dismissal, or they can be dismissed for cause when they're tenured, when they engage in irremediable conduct. And I know that Shelley is just the expert in remediable or irremediable. We sometimes play that game in the firm. It's like a game show, remediable or irremediable. And we have all kinds of crazy situations, like so-and-so threw a shoe at a student. Remediable, irremediable. It sort of depends on the shoe. Is it a Doc Martens from the 80s or is it a slipper, an UGG slipper, the scuff kind? And then we get into it. So I'll let Shelley talk a little bit about, because that's sort of the first step. If you're going to do, it's much more common, I guess I'll lead in for her. Much more common to dismiss a teacher based on irremediable conduct or violation of a notice to remedy than it is sort of the unsatisfactory rating. I think that when you do these unsatisfactory ratings and you work through a remediation plan and there's so many levels of appeal, in practice, when you go through all that, you end up settling or the teacher ends up sort of, you work them out of the system and you'll hear administrators, we're going to counsel them out. So that's a more typical end game, whereas the remediable versus irremediable ends us more often in court with Shelley.
Yes. This is where I end up oftentimes in the 20 plus years that I've been doing this. I will say that the reason I think that when Dana talks about the difference, and it's really important to remember the difference, is that an unsatisfactory rating follows typically something that's instructionally happened in the classroom. So they've gotten an unsatisfactory rating, they go into a remediation plan. That's not to say that discipline can't be included in the evaluation itself. So we have, you know, we have the component in the evaluation that talks about professional practice, and they can be received unsatisfactory if they have a performance issue in that area. However, if it's gotten to that point that is the basis for the unsatisfactory rating, it is far more likely that you have also moved in the direction of either a notice to remedy, which we think of as a conduct issue, or if we deem it to be irremediable conduct, not a notice to remedy, but rather a moving forward with the teacher dismissal process, which is, as we've mentioned a few times here, a really extensive process in terms of what you have to do and the steps you have to follow. I will tell you, Chad, that I have spoken to a number of very, very experienced administrators who have never gone through this process. So for those of you listening who are new at this and you're thinking, oh my gosh, this sounds so difficult and what's going to happen, it doesn't happen often in a lot of places. Really rely on your counsel here, because there's a lot of steps that need to be followed with respect to, well, the first and foremost, is this going to be deemed to be irremediable conduct such that the teacher can be dismissed now, as opposed to being given a warning? And then thereafter, there's a lengthy hearing process before the State Board of Education that has to be followed. And then ultimately, the teacher has the right to appeal. So it is a lengthy, expensive process for districts to go through. Very often, teachers resign prior to the hearing actually taking place, which is why I think many administrators have not actually gone through the process. And I think the price tag sometimes scares some administrators. And I will say that I've had administrators been wary of doing so. And when we follow up with the Board of Education, they feel principled about the issue and say, I do not want to allow this teacher to resign if they've done A, B, or C. And therefore, we want to go through with the hearing. And if we don't prevail, we will either at that time try to work out a deal with the teacher, or if this teacher has to come back, let it be a hearing officer or court that says they have to come back. That way it takes the pressure off the school board for having made that decision that that teacher who perhaps engaged in questionable conduct is going to be allowed back in school. So it's really nuanced, Chad, and I, you know, everyone should go through it at least once so they understand it, because without going through it, I don't think you understand kind of how big picture it should be handled.
For my next question, we're moving a little bit away from dismissal. What are the school code requirements for evaluation for teachers? And what about for principals or other administrators? And for the administrators on multi-year contracts, how do their goals factor into that evaluation?
I think I can start with respect to the requirements for evaluating teachers. So one thing that's relatively new, it's not, you know, not in the last year or so, but we do have to make sure that we give notice to the teachers who are going to be on cycle that they, and that's by the first day of student attendance, that they're get notice that they are on cycle and what the student growth components are going to be. So in terms of evaluating teachers, we have kind of two components that we look at by the school code. One is student growth and the other is professional practice. And so those two components need to be there, and tenured teachers need to be evaluated, you know, every other year. Non-tenured teachers are evaluated every year. And there are specifics with respect to how many actual formal versus informal observations there need to be by administrators that are set forth in the school code. And there really is a process that is dictated big picture from the school code, but more specifically with teacher evaluations. Each district has their own teacher evaluation plan, and how you go about evaluating a teacher and the specifics of that are typically dictated in that plan. So making sure that you familiarize yourself. It's often not in the collective bargaining agreement. For any districts that Dana and I work with, it should not be in the collective bargaining agreement because we do believe it's separate. So as a new administrator coming in, making sure you familiarize yourself with that process for evaluating teachers. I'll let Dana talk about, you know, principal evaluations as well.
So right, principals also need to be evaluated by the per the school code, and you're going to evaluate them. You're going to have your own instrument. They do need to be evaluated by March 1st. You know, there are timelines that are statutory regarding evaluation of principals, especially if you're going to look at reassigning, reclassifying the principal, or possibly non-renewing the principal in his administrative role. You know, I think the most key thing that the principal does is evaluating the teachers. So when Shelley said, really look at the evaluation plan when you're an administrator, I mean, that's something that you really need to know backwards and forwards. So making sure that you do that as a new administrator is very key. I think for anyone on a multi-year contract, they're also going to report out on the goals. And those are usually two separate processes. The goals can't be the whole evaluation. They can drive parts of the evaluation, but you're not going to capture everything that needs to be evaluated in the goals. Your goals might focus, you have those required areas of goals on student achievement and academic performance. And then you have other areas of goals, but usually don't have more than five. And you want to be able to evaluate, you know, give feedback. Evaluation is really about feedback. It's about getting people better at their jobs and giving them the tools to do that. And that's why I think it's less common to see dismissal hearings out of evaluation, but still like one of the most important things. I know we're not supposed to talk about COVID, but like it sort of gave me pause when people were saying we're not going to evaluate at all during COVID. And I do think it's different and it's okay to suspend, but that's really the community's way of knowing that there is someone, you know, overseeing quality instruction in the building. You know, it's the whole purpose of having an administrator is to make sure there's quality instruction. You know, not to keep people in from recess or, you know, do the other things that they do. Not that those aren't important, but it's such an important function.
I want to add one other thing, Chad, that I think for especially, you know, our non-principal listeners who might be in an administrative role for the first time and charged with evaluating principals, making sure that they hit those deadlines. Because there is a section of the law that refers to if you do not evaluate a principal by the time frame required by law, that they have their contract roll over on the same terms for the following year. So missing that deadline is particularly important that you make sure you don't do that. So I would also just, you know, familiarize yourself with the teacher evaluation plan, but also making sure that you're hitting those deadlines for your principals and assistant principals as
well. Absolutely. There's lots of things we can fix, but a missed deadline, evaluating the principal on April 1 rather than March 1, we can't really go back and fix that.
Great. Thank you. To everyone listening, don't miss the deadline. All right. Our next question. Let's say that there's a district that needs to cut teachers or educational support staff due to financial circumstances. How is that reduction handled for teachers? What are the rules that apply, and how would that work for support staff?
So Shelley alluded to this earlier. A reduction in force is not just something that applies to non-tenured teachers. You can't do a reduction in force by saying you're going to just cut all the non-tenured teachers. It might work out that way after you look at your honorable dismissal list, but that's not how you should envision it or picture it in your mind. So you're going to start with the rating system, and there's a very detailed process in the school code of what grouping that you go in based on your rating that you receive as a teacher. Obviously, the teachers that are rated excellent in their past two evaluations, those are the top teachers. Those are the ones that are at the very, they are not low on the totem pole, as we say. They are high on the totem pole. They are not going to be cut. So that's the first step. And then the second step is making sure you meet all the notice requirements. And again, this is another one of those things that you need to make sure you do it on time. And of course, there's not like a date certain in the school code. It's the good old 45 days before the end of the school term, which if you see Shelly with her calendar pointing her finger at the dates and counting, because that's how I do it. I shouldn't say that, but I actually do that. I think that is an important exercise that you're really counting the days to make sure that you get that timeline right. Anything else you can think of to highlight that's important, Shelly?
I think you've touched on most of those. You know, I think that just for maybe some of our administrators listening who are wondering, you know, how does this suddenly, you know, how does it apply to tenured teachers who are coming from another state? Just remember that, you know, a number of years ago when Dana and I started practicing, the process she's talking about really didn't apply to tenured and non-tenured teachers the same way. That is a difference in the last, you know, how long now? I mean, 10 years, maybe, uh-huh. 8 years. But we really do, evaluations matter more than ever for honorable dismissals of teachers, because that's how they're going to be determined, what group they fall in, so what order you're going to follow for dismissal. So evaluations have taken on a whole new meaning because of that change that occurred in 2012.
Right. And I think with support staff, it's absolutely the old way. It's opposite. So it's your last hired, or you're going to be your first out. So it's a different sort of reduction, and it's a different process entirely. The least senior people are the ones that are going to go. It's not going to be based on their rating. It's a purely mathematical application. It's not like you are a great lunch aide. You're a so-so lunch aide. We get to keep the great lunch aide. We don't if the great lunch aide doesn't have as much seniority as the mediocre lunch aide. So it's all by seniority. There are no timelines for that too, and it's a 30-day notice. You know, there's an exception, and you can do a 5-day notice if it's involved with one particular student. So you might have, say you have a very intense special ed student that you're servicing in your district, and they decide to move to a neighboring district, and you have a one-to-one aide with them, you might reduce that aide if they moved and use the shorter notice period. But generally it's 30 days, and generally it's, you know, last hired, first to be let go.
Yeah, and just to make sure, put a fine point on this distinction, is that for teachers, it's 45 days before the end of the school term. For support staff, it's 30 days before the effective date of dismissal. So you can release support staff mid-year if you follow the notice provisions. I would highly recommend that everyone listening who has any role in this to look at your collective bargaining agreement with your support staff and make sure that you know if there is something more restrictive in there or not, because I've certainly seen a fair share that only allow for dismissal, for instance, 30 days before the end of the school term, which is more restrictive than the school code. And certainly something, you know, as we're seeing, and I know we're not supposed to talk about COVID, but certainly this brings it up, is that there could be emergencies that come up in circumstances where you just don't need that many support staff for whatever reason. And if you have that term in your negotiated agreement, you're going to be stuck with that until the end of the school year, as opposed to being able to release those folks mid-year if you need to. So.
Great. Thank you for that reminder, Shelly. Another note to all of our IASA members listening, know your CBA well, especially if you're taking action against an employee of the district. All right. Changing gears a bit, moving on to employee discipline, what are the differences between discipline and evaluation? What timelines apply to each?
Well, I started to touch on this earlier. You know, when we talk about discipline, we are typically talking about a conduct issue. So has the employee, whether it's a teacher or support staff, done something that warrants disciplinary action? Where we're looking at the evaluation process, that is something that's dictated by your teacher evaluation plan. I've often seen other kind of support staff evaluation plan or documents, and that's typically done annually. Maybe it's done earlier for probationary support staff members, for instance. Maybe they have one or two in their first year. But in terms of the evaluation process, that is going to be typically instructional. And we look at kind of all the different domains that we're looking at. However, as I indicated before, domain four, for all of you using Danielson, which I think is the vast majority now, there is that professionalism component. So we can see some discipline areas noted in evaluation, but that is really talking about, you know, things like instruction, classroom management, those pieces that are different than something someone needs to be disciplined about. Someone who's not doing a good job instructing, for instance, is not necessarily going to be disciplined for that. They might be evaluated out, they might be counseled out, but that's not the same sort of action we're taking, is that we want to make sure that we are disciplining you to correct your action moving forward. It's not as much as a teaching opportunity as evaluation should be. The timelines, evaluations, as we mentioned before, you know, for administrators, it's one thing. For teachers, it is typically dictated in your plan. Given the time you have to notify non-tenured teachers for honorable dismissal or non-renewal, being 45 days for the end of the school term, we typically see those evaluations being done in February, being completed in February to make sure that we know what the ratings are going to be. But that's just helps facilitate that other process that I was referring to. So no specific timelines I can really point to other than those, but we certainly use those two processes very differently in the world of school law.
Right. And just to, like, discipline is, evaluation has a season to it to some degree because of the timelines that we've discussed, but discipline happens all the time, and it has to happen when the misconduct occurs. You can't, if someone, you know, we get these calls sometimes where someone says, I really, this teacher is like, you know, been repeatedly late, and I want to do a letter of reprimand, or I want to take it a step further and do a notice to remedy. And we're talking about like how many times, and the person will say, oh, they've been late 6 times. And we'll say, when's the last time they were late? And they'll say 2 months ago. And, you know, it's not that it's not still bad to be late. It's still bad. That's still a not a good thing to do as an employee. But if you've waited 2 months without giving any notice to the person of the problem, it's harder to discipline the person. Because when, you know, to effectuate discipline, you need notice, which is just, what did you do wrong? And then you need, you know, opportunity to be heard. You need, that person needs to tell you why they're late. And then you need to make a judgment on why they're late and go forward. So you can't just delay always. I always, you know, I know people are busy, but I think that when something happens in a school district that needs to be corrected, it's just like in the classroom. You know, you would never tell an eighth grade kid, you know, that thing you did last Wednesday, never do that again. He's not going to remember, or she's not going to remember what they did last Wednesday. Even if you describe it, they may not remember. So it's got to be in the moment, and it's got to be close to when the misconduct occurred.
Thank you, Dana. What about the concept of progressive discipline? And when would compliance with this standard be required?
Well, progressive discipline, I like to think of, and I used to teach eighth grade, as sort of the Alice in Wonderland, no off with their heads instantly. So you can't be off with someone's head if they're late for work one day. There's got to be, the discipline sort of has to match what the misconduct is. So in misconduct like being late, you know, not having things prepared to the level of, you know, not having a lesson plan has a great objective or something like that, you're not going to be able to say, okay, you didn't, you know, I wanted the lesson plan written in this format and you used, you know, I wanted it in A format, you used B format, now off with your head, you're fired as a teacher. You can't go from 0 to 60 like that. There's got to be, you know, some initial correction, and it's really steps. It's like steps on the ladder. You're going to keep moving up if the person doesn't correct. So you need to establish that you've done that for these lower level incidents of misconduct. For things that are bad, I mean, Shelley talked about that. If it's irremediable, it's irremediable, and progressive discipline does not apply.
Yeah, so like, just to add to that, you know, there are certainly some contracts actually spell out what disciplinary progressive action needs to be taken. So it'll say, initially you have to have a verbal warning, then you have to have a written warning, then you have to have a paid suspension, then you have to have an unpaid suspension, and then you can move forward with dismissal. So sometimes it's specifically laid out that way. Other times it's not. Now that's generally accepted by arbitrators as the process for progressive discipline. But I say go back again, look at your agreement, because there should also be a provision in there that says, in circumstance that so warrant, progressive discipline does not need to be followed. And that really is more with support staff than with teachers even, just to clarify that if someone does something egregious, that the district doesn't have to just give them a written warning for it. My favorite is people who are, you know, not showing up for work, and we get to the point in the progressive discipline policy where they have a paid suspension. You know, how in the world does that make sense? The problem is they're not showing up for work, and the agreement says we have to give them a paid suspension before we can dismiss them, which is exactly what they're wanting anyway. So just being clear as to what your policies are saying and making sure that they don't restrict you further than what the law otherwise would do.
What about the process for support staff dismissal?
Yeah, so I think that for cause, it's very similar to what I referenced before with respect to probationary teachers, except that you may actually have something in your board policy or in the negotiated agreement with that group of employees that dictates what the process will be. But it's more often than not the process that Dana just referenced. I mean, providing them notice with what the issue is, notice of what the recommendation is, and giving them an opportunity to respond to that recommendation and to the underlying facts as to, you know, for instance, I believe this person was misrepresenting what I did, or I engaged in that conduct, but I don't think it warrants a dismissal. And that is typically the process when you're looking at for cause, remembering that only the Board of Education can actually dismiss someone, but in a support staff situation, it is often the superintendents that's making the recommendation that has gone through the due process with the underlying employee, and the superintendent that's presenting to the school board the basis for the recommendation. So that's for cause, separate for the, you know, on the dismissal process that we talked about earlier, if you're doing it because of a reduction in the need for that many support staff members. So those are two very different processes that we follow.
Okay, we have covered a lot of ground during our discussion today. Let's close with some final thoughts. What are the best practices for districts given these topics that we discussed of discipline, evaluation, dismissal? What are the most important things that they need to keep in mind?
So I'll just start. I think the most important thing in making sure your discipline and evaluation processes run smoothly is communication. You have to have enough communication in different formats. You have to be very clear, very explicit, and making sure that you're telling the employee, whether the employee, it's just one employee, or whether it's the union rep who's representing a whole group of employees, or even higher than that, whether it's the service, the field service, or the Uniserve rep, making sure that the lines of communication are open and you're expressing to that group of people how you're going to handle things. This is how we're going to do it, so that it's not shocking to them when it actually happens. Shelley, what would you say?
Well, I think that in terms of my best practices when I think about discipline and evaluation is recognizing that this is one of the more difficult things that administrators do in their jobs. You're not alone in that. You know, as partners in a law firm, we also experience this. And despite the numerous trainings that Dana and I give on how to effectively give a great evaluation and be honest and use direct language and don't sugarcoat things, you know, we still find ourselves preparing evaluations for our own staff that we sometimes don't follow those to the letter, those guidelines to the letter. But I would say just remember that this is for, when you're talking about evaluation especially, the more honest you can be and straightforward, the more likely you're going to help facilitate change in that person and make them a better employee, whether it's a support staff member or a teacher. So really just being as honest as you can without being cruel. There are, you know, multiple ways to say the same thing, and finding that right balance so the person understands that you are concerned about the conduct and these are the steps they can do to make it better. And recognizing your own limitations that it's not an easy process to follow.
Fantastic advice. Dana, Shelley, thank you so much for joining the podcast today.